Hello everyone and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshin Works, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, the economy, and policy, and they are reframing how we build for resilient futures. In this podcast series, we're examining the ways that dynamic systems of information, incentive, and interaction are reshaping societal systems of governance and network orchestration. Traditional boundaries and operating norms are being updated. Actually, they're being replaced with ecosystemic models, our new economic engines for the digital era. I'm your host today. I'm Marco Annunziata, co-founder of Annunziata and Desai Advisors. I'm an economics PhD, former chief economist and head of business innovation strategy at General Electric. Prior to GE, I worked in policy and in finance. My expertise lies at the intersection of global economic and financial trends with technology and innovation. My guest today, very honored to welcome Ras Matijevic. Ras, Mr. Wizard Matijevic, is the owner and chief executive of Matijevic International Consulting, a small veteran-owned business focused on an eclectic mix of value-added services and products. Ras is a retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel with over 35 years of aerospace, aviation, and maritime experience. He has extensive experience working with the U.S. Departments of Defense, State, Commerce, with the U.S. Intelligence Community, and with NASA. During his military career, Ras led teams on worldwide deployments integrating space-based solutions into tactical environments. He was the chief engineer for the Transformational Communications Satellite Space Segment, and he retired as the Deputy Director of Space Policy within the Office of the Secretary of Defense. Since his retirement from active duty in 2011, Ras has served in key executive positions with Northrop Grumman, Hawkeye 360, BAE System, and most recently as the Chief Innovation Officer for Airbus U.S. Space and Defense, where he provided technical vision and guidance to multiple lines of business, resulting in the highest contract win rate in Airbus U.S. history. Ras holds a Bachelor of Science degree in Aerospace Engineering from Mississippi State and a Master's of Science degree in Astronautical Engineering from West Coast University. He's an accomplished competitive sailboat racer. He's also an award-winning photographer and enjoys songwriting and playing his guitar in what I guess is his ample spare time. Ras, I'm delighted to have you. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Marco. It's great to be here.
It is really, really a huge pleasure to be with you today. We have a lot to discuss. You've been on both sides of the fence. You've been in government, you've been in private industry. As you assess the state of play today, specifically in the US, of this division of labor between government and the private sector, and their interaction and collaboration on the innovation space, and I'm thinking specifically of innovations and technologies which are potentially of strategic importance, What's your assessment of where we stand now, and what do you think we could be doing better?
That's a great question. We are in a very strange place right now. Basically, you've got government who has, from my perspective, they've abdicated their role in funding innovation and research and really driving technology development because they say, oh, we're going to harness what the commercial industry is doing. We want to innovate at the speed of commercial industry. And so they've just kind of basically given it over to industry to go do all these great things. Industry says, okay, I need some assurance that when I do make this investment and I take my time and my treasure and I go down this path, that when I'm done, that you government are going to buy what I have developed. And then you get into the situation where the government says, oh, but, you know, I want your innovation, but I want it as a viable commercial product. I don't want to be your sole customer because I don't want you dependent upon me. So once you become commercially viable, then I'll look at it. But before I can commit, you know, I really need to do an analysis of alternatives. And at that point, if you're a startup, your venture capitalists who have been funding you are just like, whoa, wait a minute. You said that the government wanted this technology. I was like, well, yeah, they do, but it's the government. And it's this tension that we're in right now where you've got government saying, yeah, we want innovation from industry. And then industry says, okay, I've innovated. Here's my widget. And the government's like, come back and talk to me when you're commercially viable. So it's you get into this weird do loop of how do you move forward? Now, in some instances, like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, where you've got this massive independent source of investment coming in, where they're going. And they don't really care if the government comes along or not. They're going to go, they've got their thing, and they're going to go do their thing. And for them, it works. But those are very unique circumstances. And for most of the private companies out there, most of the startups out there, they are really struggling because you've got the VCs coming in and says, oh, yeah, we're going to do this. And you got to develop your U.S. market, you know, your U.S. government. You know, I'm going to talk for U.S. government terms here. And I'm sure it's the same in other countries as well. But at least within the U.S. market, you've got a startup who goes to their VC backers and private equity investors. And everybody thinks, okay, I'm going to get this product, this new innovative thing, and then I'm going to sell it to the government first. And that is a very, very difficult thing to do. You've got to really establish your commercial or your international markets. You've got to show that it's viable. And then the government may start buying it. But it's really difficult to go that path because you've got these, you know, two sources of headwinds. Your investors who are saying, sell to the government because they're the big market player, which is true. And then you have the government saying, I don't want to be the sole supporter of this business. And quite frankly, and this might, it's in no way, derogatory towards Digital Globe, today's Maxar, but Digital Globe is kind of the first company to make this an issue when there was a cut in commercial remote sensing budget dollars several years ago. And Digital Globe complained to the DoD. It's like, oh, you're killing us. And I think it was Secretary Gates at the time said, well, you're supposed to be a commercial entity. What percentage of your revenue comes from the U.S. government? And by the time, you know, Digital Globe went back and did some figuring and stuff, they came back to Gates and said, that's about 75%. It's like 75% U.S. government funding, DoD funding, 75%. You're not a commercial entity. You're a defense contractor. And at that point, all the startups were getting asked, well, what's your commercial market? What's your market share? Are you viably commercial? Because I don't want to be paying for you. And then you go out of business when I have to cut my budget because of whatever reason. And so since that time, you've got all this pressure that's happening. And the companies are going to be successful, the ones who can navigate that tension and that valley of death, if you will, between what their investors want and what the market's going to do.
It's a genuinely difficult problem, right? Because I can see the other side of the coin, which is the government also might fear being criticized if it effectively extends guarantees to companies as they start developing products. And we've seen some of that debate in the green energy space, where government essentially extends some sort of safety net to companies to deliver technologies that are believed to be for the common good. And then if the experiment doesn't work, then you'll have newspaper articles saying, well, the government is doing these benefits and subsidies, and it's wasted money, wasting taxpayers' money. So it's a genuinely very hard problem to solve.
Yes. Yes, it is. And I do not pretend that I have the solution. But I think there are ways you can be smart about it. So my very first professional opportunity I had post-university, I was an ROTC graduate, Air Force ROTC graduate. At that point in time in 1988, the Air Force had a policy that if you're an ROTC graduate, you would come on to active duty, but at some point in the future. And they weren't really sure when it would be, but it would be no more than 12 months. Well, for me, it ended up being just about 12 months or so. So I needed a job between graduation and coming on to active duty. And I got one at the Mississippi State Rasket Flight Research Laboratory. And we had a contract, or they had a contract, with Honda Research and Development Corporation on how to design, build, and test all composite airplanes. So I was talking with the president of Honda R&D one time at a dinner meeting, and I asked them how did everything work? How were they sourced? How were they funded? And basically it was a philosophy that Honda, big Honda, would take a percentage of their profits and fully fund Honda R&D with the mandate of go innovate, go experiment, go look for new products, do the market research, find these new things. And when you find something that you think is marketable, come back to us and let's discuss. And the interesting thing is they started down the path of composites as an alternative to using metal to manufacture automobiles. But then they realized that composites really aren't the best material for automotive manufacture because they don't have, they're not good at impacts. You know, they're not going to absorb, they're just basically going to break. But they were great for aircraft. And so Honda R&D went and figured out, hey, we can make airplanes. And now Honda Aircraft in North Carolina is making the Honda Jet. And it's kind of, it's a trendsetter, if you will. It's an innovative approach to the business jet because they took the engines and instead of mounting them on the fuselage, like most business jets do, they're mounted on wing pylons, which basically greatly diminish cabin noise. So it's an innovative approach using an all composite manufacturing design. And it's a great little aircraft. And that to me is something to look at. You know, that could be an example to the startups of look, you know, look at what you can do, find that need that the market's going to want, but then also educate your investors along the way and get them to understand that there's not going to be this immediate adoption by the government. But if you can go and get enough commercial interest, or if you can get enough international interest, it's almost like, you know, playing hard to get when you're an adolescent and in the dating game, you know, dating world, and you know, playing hard to get. If I'm not, you know, I'm not going to talk to you, I'm not going to do business to you because I'm busy over here. Then what does that person do? Oh, I'm very interested in you because you're not talking to me. Why aren't you talking to me? It sounds childish at first blush, but I think there's some realism to that. Is, you know, the companies that are out there doing their thing and are not dependent on the government, all of a sudden the government's like, hey, I want some of that. So again, I don't have the solutions, but I have these areas that I think are worth careful thought and consideration and internal debate. I was just watching a very interesting quick little video, and it basically was talking about crowdsourced wisdom. And if you ask a bunch of people an unknowable question, over time, if they individually provide inputs, you're going to get very close to the very, you know, to the correct answer. Nobody will generally have the correct answer, but if you ask all these individuals and get these individual inputs, you'll get that answer. And it's, you know, the collective wisdom. However, what this one video was about was they had taken a jar of jelly beans and put it out and said, hey, guess how many jelly beans are in there? And the data was completely off of what all these other experiments on the same thing had proven, but the jelly bean experiment was not right. So they looked at it. It's like, okay, what's going on here? And then they realized they were allowing people who came to the table to provide their input. They would sit there and they would go back and forth and they would kind of reach a consensus, or it's like, oh, you guessed 10,000. Well, I'm going to guess 10,001 because I'm going to beat you. I'm going to Price is Right you. And all of a sudden, the independence of just what's your gut tell you? You know, not trying to get consensus. Let's get data. Let's get data and see what the data says and then go where the data leads us versus what their consensus leads us. And I think that's what's missing, is you've got so many organizations that are trying to get to consensus versus encouraging and benefiting from the natural tension of different ideas. I had a supervisor of mine several years ago. I was brought in because they needed somebody with spacelift experience, and everybody else in the organization, their experience was launching intercontinental ballistic missiles. My experience was launching rockets with satellites on them. And, you know, at face value, you could say, oh, well, they're both using rocket technology, and, you know, one's delivering a bomb, the other one's delivering a satellite. But there were key differences in the approach and how you did things. And especially at that point in time, the U.S. Air Force was contracting a launch service, whereas an ICBM was an actual weapon system that was procured and operated and maintained by Air Force personnel. So I was constantly butting heads with my supervisor in a respectful manner, but he would say, okay, I think we need to do A, B, C, and D. It's like, well, if you did A, then this will happen. You can't do B because that's not how it works. And C is it's really however good the contract's written. But I was always giving him a contrarian view. So at my going away, he basically stated that he truly appreciated and valued my contrarian perspective, because when two individuals in an organization consistently agree, one of them is unnecessary. And to me, that is really one of the giant problems that we have right now, is you get these organizations and you very quickly get into groupthink because you're trying to build consensus. And consensus is not going to lead to success. Consensus is just going to lead to resource consumption without progress. In fact, I saw a great little meme, and it said, do not mistake motion for progress. And it showed a little child's rocking horse. And that to me is if you want to sum it up in just one little statement, is do not mistake motion for progress.
No, it's very true and very striking. What you're pointing at, what you're highlighting, which is the difference between the wisdom of the crowds on one side and groupthink on the other, is extremely important. It's one of the reasons, for example, in my mind, why economic forecasts are so often systematically wrong, because they're not independent, because I've been in that game, because if you're making economic forecasts, you will go and look at what everybody else is forecasting because you're afraid of being out there and then looking like an idiot. So with very few exceptions, you just end up having not independent assessments of the situation, but groupthink, people trying to converge. So it's very interesting. And on the other issue, the issue of how to best structure a cooperation between government and private entities, I think you've put your finger on it, which is there is not a single right solution, but a setup where companies struggle to compete, to be commercially viable, play hard to get, as you said, you're signaling to the government that, look, we have other options. It's probably a lot healthier. It also creates a stronger incentive for government to figure out which technologies, which companies to pay more attention to, especially in a situation where strategic imperatives are becoming more and more salient as the geopolitical situation becomes more unsettled. So that is probably the way to go. In the end, if you look at it from a geopolitical perspective, it feels to me like the advantage the U.S. has always had is the vibrant private sector. So if we try, the government is extremely important. The government is hugely important, but we can certainly do private sector better than China. Can we do government better than China? Maybe, but maybe that's not where we should be focusing our efforts.
Well, I'm not sure if the Chinese approach to government innovation would fly in the U.S. government.
I suspect probably not. Speaking of this, Russ, I'm curious, in your space, what are the emergent technologies and the innovation games that you find most exciting and most promising at the moment?
I think there is this intersection between unmanned systems, autonomy, and then machine learning. And I don't like really calling it artificial intelligence, because at the end of the day, it's a computer, and a computer is just as good as its programming. And we learned early on, at least my experience in doing big data, data analytics, predictive analytics, things like that, going back to the conversation between, you know, collective wisdom and groupthink. And just as you said, with economic forecasts, we see the same thing in big data. There are collection biases and there are data biases. And so cleansing that data is huge. But, you know, there are very well-paid data scientists who are working on those issues. But I think going forward, what you can do with an unmanned system and autonomy is going to be very, very interesting. I think that's a really, and you can make the case that satellites were the very first unmanned system. Because I mean, when I was flying Discus 3s back in the early 90s, it was basically a radio controlled vehicle. It had its source code. I would tell it to do things. It would go do things. It would report back. And between its software and Kepler, it did its thing and worked. Then we moved to aircraft with radio controlled airplanes and things like that. Now we're starting to see unmanned surface vessels doing some really neat stuff. There's a company called Saildrone that launches these unmanned autonomous or semi-autonomous systems. And they have a sail, and they will sail across the oceans, mapping the floor, doing data collection on ocean climate states. They've sailed them into hurricanes and provided, you know, in situ reporting of the hurricane. And all that's being done on an unmanned system. So I think you could do that. That's going to expand our ability to understand things far better than we're currently doing. Yeah, it's kind of like, they made the case that we don't need reconnaissance airplanes because we can get everything we need from space. Not really, but that, you know, so you've got lots of space satellites, you know, looking at the Earth, but you still need stuff on the Earth collecting data, you know, in the atmosphere, in the ocean. Yeah, we know more about outer space than we know about the bottom of the ocean. And so there's lots of interesting things. And I think to truly understand the Earth system, you really have to understand the oceans, because the oceans really drive our climate. They are the source of energy. You know, well, the sun is a source of energy. The oceans are the source of fuel, if you will. And so understanding that, and unmanned systems are going to allow us to do that. And you could do that for delivery of goods and a lot of transport routes. You could probably make them autonomous. There are, you know, everybody joked about, you know, the Amazon package delivery via drone. But there's a company right now in Africa that is doing that on a daily basis with medical supplies. And here is their innovation. They took a page out of landing manual for Mars missions, and they wrapped the package in this giant cushion. And as the drone gets over the delivery point, it just drops it and the thing bounces to a halt. And now you have your package. So, you know, it's not all innovation is earth breaking. And that's, I guess, I like to characterize it. You have capital I innovation, which are those big, bodacious, earth shattering things. And then you have the little I innovations that don't get the acknowledgement, but they're almost more important. You know, the old saying, the way to win a baseball game is base hits. You know, yeah, you should always swing for the fence, but base hits win the game. And it's those little I innovations that every company can do. And if every company doesn't have a little innovation engine that is looking at how can I do internal processes better? How can I get the sand out of my gears? How can I remove the inefficiencies? How can I eliminate duplication of efforts? I mean, that is another huge area that once you do that, now you're going to be far more profitable, far more productive, and your workforce is going to be more energetic because they're going to feel engaged and they feel like they have a voice and you're doing things with purpose versus just stuck in endless meetings and online polls and things like that.
So in a sense, it's looking at innovation on a broader base, right? It's innovation beyond technology, or rather technology tied to the organizational context, to the economic incentives, to even the environmental context of the problem you're trying to solve, and then focusing on what do I really need? What can really move the needle? And maybe it is the most advanced technology innovation that you have. Maybe something else that's been sitting there and available for quite a while.
Exactly. For example, if you have a company that is manufacturing multiple products, you know, let's say you're doing aircraft and helicopters and satellites and ships or whatever, and look at the commonalities between those different product lines. And if you've got, or let's say that you've got an up and running line and now you bring up a new product. But if you have an aircraft, you have a helicopter, you have a ship, you have a spacecraft, they're going to need power. They're going to need some sort of processing and you know, command and control system. They're going to need wiring harnesses. You know, they may need heaters. They may need all these common things. So rather than duplicate the capabilities across all those lines of business, could you have one entity? Let's take wire harnesses, for instance. A wire harness the only real differences between a wire harness in an aircraft, in a helicopter, in a ship, in a land vehicle, or a satellite is the regulatory input and certain environmental considerations. And those are things that you can build into the manufacturing plan for a given wire harness. And so if I have a harness shop that is building an aircraft wiring harness that is multiple miles long, they should be able to make my spacecraft harness, which is not nearly as long, but might have more exacting specifications on what materials I use, what bend radii, how much shielding, things like that. But again, that's just an instruction page in the manufacturing process. And you can, you know, just work through your production line. And that's a way where you can reduce your overhead, reduce your capital expenditures on having these multiple versions. You know, why should you have a wiring shop for aircraft and helicopters and satellites? And I'm oversimplifying the scenario here for discussion, but it's those types of things of, let's find the commonalities. And for companies now, when you've got a product, you don't necessarily need to make the next big product. If you could find an adjacent market that could benefit from maybe a slightly altered version of your product. And so what's the, you know, and that's a smaller innovation to get into that adjacent market. And so it's the creativity and having people encouraging the feedback from the workforce. From your business development people, from your customer engagement folks, and your market survey folks, and finding the right nonprofits and industry associations that are out there that are providing that data that you can then sift through and say, oh, you know what? I think we could capture this market over here that we've never been to if we just made this 10% change to our existing product lines.
Exactly. And it's also being smart about the economics and the cost effectiveness of it all. Because it almost brings me back to the previous conversation we had about the Apollo program. Because again, people who now argue about the importance of government involvement, often from, and I'm speaking from the evil side of the economic science, but often they will make this argument that because government is so important to research and innovation, the government should be spending more, and it's good for the government to borrow more and spend more. And I always point out, guys, if you look at the data, we went to the moon on essentially a balanced budget. And now we're running consistent deficits of 6-7% of GDP. So don't tell me it's an issue of money. It's an issue of being smart about how you deploy the money.
How you deploy the money. And again, looking for those inefficiencies within the organization. And NASA is a good example of that right now. And this is my personal experience. when I was on active duty, when it was time, when we were launching rockets, you know, we basically, after the Challenger explosion, they decided that all defense missions would go on expendables. The DoD would not launch on the space shuttle anymore. So the Air Force launched expendables. NASA did the shuttle. But NASA also was the executive agent for all civil launches. Even though they were launching on Air Force rockets, NASA was in charge. Why? And so I was launching a 1961 vintage Atlas E in late 1994. And it was the NOAA J weather satellite. Basically, it was the polar low Earth orbit weather satellite for NASA. Program name escapes me at the moment, but NASA had an entire facility and an army of people to oversee the Air Force overseeing the contractor, because NASA was in charge of civil launches. And to this day, it's still there. NASA is the program management entity for all of the NOAA spacecraft acquisitions. So why? When you've got a space force that is acquiring. So is there cost savings there? Same thing with NASA studying the Earth. You know, they claim that, oh, we're going to do the mission to planet Earth because that's going to train us how to study other planets more efficiently. It's like, okay, but don't we have an organization called the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration that is looking at the Earth and looking at the environment? So why are we duplicating those efforts? And could NASA be more effective if they focused on what they're supposed to be doing, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration? I tried to find it. It's somewhere in a box somewhere, but I have a book of airfoil data, and it's about this thick. And it was produced by NASA's predecessor, the National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics. And they basically went out and did a bunch of wind tunnel testing and calculations and all these different airfoil shapes, and then put it in a reference book. So if you were, and this is a great example of how government can drive innovation in industry. They went out and did something that is completely non-profitable, but value added by doing all this research. And it's just brute force, put an airfoil in, run the wind tunnel, do the measurements, do the characteristics, publish the data, make it available for everybody to use. Then I, as an aircraft designer, I can grab my book. It's like, you know what? I got this idea for this short takeoff and landing aircraft that I'm going to put some vertical rotors on it, and it's going to take off vertically, and it's going to sit, you know, fly horizontally, and it's going to land vertically, and I'll use it for urban transportation. I could go to this data and I could find the exact airfoils that I need for both the horizontal flight and the vertical flight. And I don't have to invest that research dollars myself. It's there. But since NACA became NASA, they've kind of focused on the space side of it, and they haven't really done as much on the aerodynamic side of it, which, I mean, you could make the case that the aeronautical industry is up and running and they don't need as much help as the space industry needs. But I think if NASA focused on those core essentials, looking out into deep space beyond Earth, looking at cislunar, looking at Mars, looking at the solar system, I mean, James Webb is a huge step forward. But even what the next great telescope, space telescope, is going to be after Webb, it's running into competition with all the other things that NASA's trying to do. And then you look on the X-plane side of it, and there's really very little, at least from what I have seen. There may be stuff happening that just doesn't make, you know, doesn't cross the press threshold. But it's, I think, again, identifying what are your core competencies? What is your passion? What should you be doing? And then do that, finding the duplication, eliminating that, and then, you know, moving forward to make better use of the dollars that you have.
It's completely right. You know, our podcast is about ecosystemic futures, and what you're highlighting is the importance of allowing the ecosystem to structure itself in the correct way, with the right division of labor, with an efficient system of collaboration and sharing of information. So it's exactly right. Russ, we're coming up to the end of our time together. We had a fantastic, fascinating conversation, covered a huge range of topics. Is there anything, but we could keep going Joe Rogan style for another 2 hours. We are gradually building our audience's patience for this. So we'll get there in our next conversation with you. But for today, is there anything we haven't covered that we should have, or any message really would like the audience to take away from our conversation?
I think, to me, I mean, there's a lot of angst right now because of the geopolitical landscape that we find ourselves in. And I guess I have an optimistic view, because I still believe in the power of the American people. It seems like we have been, or more and more people are kind of been lured into this, I don't want to say a coma, but it's a combination of social media and entertainment. And our country has always been a centrist country. And when we come together from a centrist perspective and put aside the partisanship and just focus on what do we need to accomplish? What is in the best interests, and have the conversations. And it's okay to have different perspectives, and it's okay to have disagreeing points of view, but it's, you know, don't do the consensus thing. It's keep picking at it and working on it, honing it. You look at a sword is this beautiful piece of craftsmanship, but what that sword goes through to get to be that piece of beauty is an extraordinarily painful process if you're the sword. I mean, lots of fire, lots of hammering, lots of dousing in water, but in the end, you get this great product. And I guess my final thought is, don't despair. Don't give up on the American spirit and the American dream. You know, we can do this. We can come together as a nation, and we can reject the extremists on both sides of the aisle and focus on those centrist values that has made our nation as great as it is. And I think we can continue to be better. And sure, we've made mistakes. Every nation makes mistakes. You know, they're governed by imperfect humans. It's our nature to make mistakes. We just need to learn from those mistakes and keep moving forward together versus this back and forth that's been going on for way too long.
I couldn't agree more. This is why I decided to come here and be a part of this. So I really couldn't agree more. And it's an excellent way to end our conversation for today. Russ Matijevich, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Marco. This has been great.
And thanks, everyone, for joining us today. Please do check out this season's new episodes as we continue to explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and refactor business models, and how this convergence is reshaping industry and what it means for our ecosystemic futures. Follow us, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever your favorite place for podcasts is. And you can always learn more or apply to be a guest speaker at shoshinworks.com. Thanks, everyone.